Chapter 8. And drink to the health of sweet Nan of the Hill, was once Tommy Two's spots. As jovial they sought, as e'er drew a spigot, or drained a full pot, and drinking all round 'twas his joy to surpass, and with all merry tipplers he swigged off his glass. Nee morning in summer, while seated so snug, in the porch of his garden, discussing his jug, stern death, on a sudden, to Tom did appear, and said, "Honest Thomas, come take your last beer." Apostrophe we needed is clay in the shape of this can, from which let us drink to the health of my Nan. "Sah," said the doctor, "I've heard that song before. Here's a new one for you, boys." And Sawbones began, in a rich Circassian voice, "Who have all heard of Larry O'Toole, of the beautiful town of Drumgool? He had but one eye, to ogle ye by O, Merthyr, but that was a jewel. A fool he made of the girls, dis O'Toole. 'Twas he was the boy didn't fail, that tucked down patties and mail. He never would shrink from any strong drink, was it whiskey or dragita ale. I'm bail this Larry would swallow a pail. H. Many a night at the bowl, with Larry I've sought cheek by jowl. He's gone to his rest, where there's drink of the best, and so let us give his old sowl a howl, for 'twas he made the noggin to rowl." I observed the French colonel's eye glistened as he heard these well-known accents of his country, but we were too well-bred to pretend to remark his emotion. The sun was setting behind the mountains as our songs were finished, and each began to look out with some anxiety for the preconcerted signal, the rocket from Sir Hussey Vivian's quarters, which was to announce the recommencement of hostilities. It came just as the moon rose in her silver splendor, and ere the rocket stick fell quivering to the earth at the feet of General Picton and Sir Lowry Cole, who were at their posts at the head of the storming parties, 999 guns in position opened their fire from our batteries, which were answered by a tremendous cannonade from the fort. "Who's going to dance?" said the Doctor Cole, and the ball's begun. "Ha! There goes poor Jack Delamere's head off. The ball chose a soft one, anyhow. Come here, Tim, till I mend your leg. Your wife has need only knit half as many stockings next year, Doolin, my boy. Fakes! There goes a big one that well nigh stopped my talking. Bedded, it has snuffed the feather off my cocked hat." In this way, with 84-pounders roaring over us like hail, the undaunted little doctor pursued his jokes and his duty. That he had a feeling heart, all who served with him knew, and none more so than Philip Fogarty, the humble writer of this tale of war. Our embrasure was luckily bomb-proof, and the detachment of the Unity 1th under my orders suffered comparatively little. "E cool, boys," I said. "It will be hot enough work for you ere long." The honest fellows answered with an Irish cheer. I saw that it affected our prisoner. "Countrymen," said I know you, but an Irishman was never a traitor. "Tace his vows," said he, putting his finger to his lip. "Est la fortune de la guerre. If ever you come to Paris, ask for the Marquis d'O'Mahony, and I may render you the hospitality which your tyrannous laws prevent me from exercising in the ancestral halls of my own race." I shook him warmly by the hand as a tear bedimmed his eye. It was, then, the celebrated colonel of the Irish Brigade, created a Marquis by Napoleon on the field of Austerlitz. "Marquis," said I, "the country which disowns you is proud of you. But ah! Here, if I mistake not, comes our signal to advance." And in fact, Captain Vandeleur, riding up through the shower of shot, asked for the commander of the detachment, and bade me hold myself in readiness to move, as soon as the flank companies of the 99th and 66th and the Grenadier Brigade of the German Legion began to advance up the echelon. The devoted band soon arrived. Jack Boser heading the 99th, when was he away, and a storming party to the fore? Comma and the gallant Pistossund, with his Hanoverian veterans. The second rocket flew up. "Forward, Unity 1th!" cried I, in a voice of thunder. "Illaloo boys, follow your captain!" And with a shrill hooray, that sounded above the tremendous fire from the fort, we sprung upon the steep, Boser with the brave 99th, and the bold Pistosund, keeping well up with us. We passed the Demi-Loon, we passed the Culverin, bayoneting the artillerymen at their guns. We advanced across the two tremendous Demi-Loons which flank the counterscarp, and prepared for the final spring upon the citadel. So I could see quite pale on the wall, and the scoundrel Cambaciers, who had been so nearly my prisoner that day, trembled as he cheered his men. "En, boys, on!" I hoarsely exclaimed. "Ru!" said the fighting on the oneth. But there was a movement among the enemy. An officer, glittering with orders, and another in a gray coat and a cocked hat, came to the wall, and I recognized the Emperor Napoleon and the famous Joachim Murat. "We are hardly pressed, methinks," Napoleon said sternly. "Must exercise my old trade as an artilleryman." And Murat loaded, and the Emperor pointed the only 124-pounder that had not been silenced by our fire. "Hooray, Killaloo boys!" shouted one. The next moment a sensation of numbness and death seized me, and I lay like a corpse upon the rampart. "Two." "Hush," said a voice, which I recognized to be that of the Marquis d'O'Mahony. "Even be praised, reason has returned to you. For 6 weeks those are the only sane words I have heard from you." "Fakes, and 'tis through for you, Colonel dear," cried another voice, with which I was even more familiar. 'Twas that of my honest and gallant Lanty Clancy, who was blubbering at my bedside overjoyed at his master's recovery. "Oh musha, Master Philagraw, but this will be the great day interly, when I send off the news, which I would, barring I can't write, to the lady your mother and your sisters at Castle Fagardy, and 'tis his reverence Father Luke will jump for joy thin, when he reads the letter. 6 weeks raven and roaring as bold as a lion, and as mad as Mick Maloney's pig, that mistook Mick's wick for a cabbage, and died of eating it. And have I then lost my senses?" I exclaimed feebly. "Sure, didn't he call me your beautiful Donna Anna only yesterday, and catch hold of me whiskers, as if they were the Signora's jet-black ringlets?" Lanty cried. At this moment, and blushing deeply, the most beautiful young creature I ever set my eyes upon, rose from a chair at the foot of the bed, and sailed out of the room. "Confusion, you blundering rogue," I cried. "Who is that lovely lady whom you frightened away by your impertinence? Donna Anna? Where am I?" "You are in good hands, Philip," said the colonel. "You are at my house in the Place Vendôme, at Paris, of which I am the military governor. You and Lanty were knocked down by the wind of the cannonball at Burgos. Do not be ashamed. 'Twas the Emperor pointed the gun, and the colonel took off his hat as he mentioned the name darling to France. Then our troops returned from the sally in which your gallant storming party was driven back. You were found on the glacis, and I had you brought into the city. Your reason had left you, however, when you returned to life. But, unwilling to desert the son of my old friend, Philip Fagardy, who saved my life in 98, I brought you in my carriage to Paris. And many's the time you tried to jump out of the windy, Master Phil," said Clancy. "Brought you to Paris," resumed the colonel, smiling, "where, by the soins of my friends Brousace, Esquirrel, and Baron Larry, you have been restored to health, thank heaven." "And that lovely angel who quitted the apartment?" I cried. "That lovely angel is the Lady Blanche Sarsfield, my ward, a descendant of the gallant Lucan, and who may be, when she chooses, Madame la Marechale de Cambaciers, Duchess of Illyria. Why did you deliver the ruffian when he was in my grasp?" I cried. "Why did Lanty deliver you when in mine?" the colonel replied. "Qu'est la fortune de la guerre, mon garçon? But calm yourself, and take this potion which Blanqui has prepared for you." I drank the tisane eagerly, when I heard whose fair hands had compounded it, and its effects were speedily beneficial to me, for I sank into a cool and refreshing slumber. From that day I began to mend rapidly, with all the elasticity of youth's happy time. Blanche the enchanting Blanche ministered henceforth to me, for I would take no medicine, but from her lily hand. And what were the effects? Faith, ere a month was passed, the patient was over head and ears in love with the doctor, and as for Baron Larry, and Browsace, and Deskwirl, they were sent to the right about. In a short time I was in a situation, to do justice to the Gigadox Navis, the Bew Fox Cornichons, and the other delicious entremets of the Marquis' board, with an appetite that astonished some of the Frenchmen who frequented it. Wait till he's quite well, miss, said Lanty, who waited always behind me. Faith. When he's in health, I'd back him to aid a cow, barring the horns and teal. I sent a decanter at the rogue's head, by way of answer to his impertinence. Although the disgusting cambaciers did his best to have my parole withdrawn from me, and to cause me to be sent to the English depot of prisoners at Verdun, the Marquis's interest with the Emperor prevailed, and I was allowed to remain at Paris, the happiest of prisoners, at the Colonel's hotel at the Place Vendôme. I hear at the opportunity, an opportunity not lost, I flatter myself, on the young fellow with the accomplishments of Philip Fogarty Esquire, of mixing with the elite of French society, and meeting with many of the great, the beautiful, and the brave. Talleyrand was a frequent guest of the Marquis. His bon mots used to keep the table in a roar. Ney frequently took his chop with us. Murat, when in town, constantly dropped in for a cup of tea and friendly round game. Alas, who would have thought those two gallant heads would be so soon laid low? My wife has a pair of earrings which the latter, who always wore them, presented to her, but we are advancing matters. Anybody could see, avec un demi-el, as the Prince of Benevento remarked, how affairs went between me and Blanche. But though she loathed him for his cruelties, and the odiousness of his person, the brutal cambacier still pursued his designs upon her. I recollect it was on St. Patrick's Day. My lovely friend had procured, from the gardens of the Empress Josephine, at Malmaison, whom we loved a thousand times more than her Austrian successor, a sandy-haired woman, between ourselves, with an odious squint, a quantity of shamrock wherewith to garnish the hotel, and all the Irish in Paris were invited to the national festival. I and Prince Talleyrand danced a double hornpipe with Pauline Bonaparte and Madame de Staël. Marshal Soult went down a couple of sets with Madame Récamier, and Robespierre's widow, an excellent, gentle creature, quite unlike her husband, stood up with the Austrian ambassador. Besides, the famous artists Baron Rose, David, and Nicholas Poussin, and Canova, who was in town making a statue of the Emperor for Leo X, and, in a word, all the celebrities of Paris as my gifted countrywoman, the wild Irish girl, calls them, were assembled in the Marquis's elegant receiving rooms. At last a great outcry was raised for La Guirlandaise. La Guirlandaise. A dance which had made a furor amongst the Parisians ever since the lovely Blanche Sarsfield had danced it. She stepped forward, and took me for a partner, and amidst the bravos of the crowd, in which stood Ney, Murat, Lanz, the Prince of Wagram, and the Austrian ambassador, we showed to the beau monde of the French capital, I flatter myself, a not unfavorable specimen of the dance of our country. As I was cutting the double shuffle, and toe and heeling it in the rail style, Blanche danced up to me, smiling, and said, be on your guard. I see cambaciers talking to Fouch, the Duke of Otranto, about us, and when Otranto turns his eyes upon a man, they bode him no good. Cambaciers is jealous, said one. Have it, says she, I'll make him dance a turn with me. So, presently, as the music was going like mad all this time, I pretended fatigue from my late wounds, and sat down. The lovely Blanche went up smiling, and brought out cambaciers as a second partner. The marshal is a lusty man, who makes desperate efforts to give himself a waist, and the effect of the exercise upon him was speedily visible. He puffed and snorted like a walrus, drops trickled down his purple face, while my lovely mischief of a Blanche went on dancing a treble quick, till she fairly danced him down. Who'll take the floor with me? said the charming girl, animated by the sport. Fakes, then, 'tis I, Lanty Clancy, cried my rascal, who had been mad with excitement at the scene, and, stepping in with a whoop and a hurroo, he began to dance with such rapidity as made all present stare. As the couple were footing it, there was a noise, as of a rapid cavalcade traversing the Place Vendôme, and stopping at the Marquis's door. A crowd appeared to mount the stair, the great doors of the reception room were flung open, and two pages announced their majesties the Emperor and the Empress. So engaged were Lanty and Blanche, that they never heard the tumult occasioned by the august approach. It was indeed the Emperor, who, returning from the Theatre Francais, and seeing the Marquis's windows lighted up, proposed to the Empress to drop in on the party. He made signs to the musicians to continue, and the conqueror of Marengo and Friedland watched with interest the simple evolutions of two happy Irish. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.